As I often start out addressing these talks, it's important to realize that the human brain, which is of course the most powerful evolutionary tool, the most powerful tool in the universe, it was, even though it's so powerful and has so many amazing abilities, it was pretty much hardwired tens of thousands of years ago for a different world, a world where there was danger and threats everywhere, where the human lifespan was generally around 20 years, where other clans of Homo sapiens and the dying out, Cro-Magnons, were constantly on attack, and where there was dangerous animals and famines and diseases, and there was a lot to worry about. And so the human brain is set up to really reward us and encourage us into survival first, ask questions second mindset. That's the way we are born. We are born into those minds, those brains. Now, these brains were extremely effective tools in that they allowed us to become the dominant species on the planet very quickly. And obviously the brain is, with its myriad of trillions of neural connections, is a vast, powerful tool to have at our disposal. But it's also, of course, prone to, now that the world has changed and there's much fewer threats, even though New York, and I'm sure that living in 2011 can seem a stressful environment, believe me, it was a much more dangerous place for us 40,000 years ago. So we have unnecessarily agitated brains, brains that are set up to expect death to come at us constantly from every direction, expecting food sources to be extremely rare, expecting any chance for nourishment or sexual gratification to be extremely fleeting. So the brain is set up to really, really, really kick into action, and we have all hyperactive amygdalas and emotional centers which flood us with cortisol and adrenaline and dopamine. At the slightest inconvenience now, the brain jumps about. You can be at a meeting, for example, or perhaps have somebody cut you off in a car or not hold an elevator door. And the human brain can act as if we're being charged by a wild elephant, because that's the way the emotional centers are set up. We are set up to be really worried, agitated, just like every other animal. We're set up to, basically, our survival instincts are set up on a hair trigger. There was an interesting set of experiments by a scientist named Thorndike. Basically, he might have been a clinical behaviorist. I'm not sure. I have to remind myself. But anyway, he put a cat in a cage with a very big lever that would instantly open the door to the cage. And the cats, when they were in a normal position, would just, without any stressors, would pretty quickly figure out the lever mechanism, hit the button, and they'd go out. But put a piece of salmon outside of the cage, and the cat will just claw at the bars and reach and try to grab the salmon that's out of reach, and will never bother to push the lever, because the presence of craving or an object to be desired is right in front of it. Its survival instincts kick in, and it can't think outside of doing the things that it is conditioned to do when it's in a stressful situation. The human mind beyond its, obviously we have the ability to run and to fight and all that, but really what the human mind excels at when we're under stress is excessive thought, obsession, trying to figure everything out, even when we don't have anywhere near enough information. If you really want to screw somebody, tell their boss to say to them, on Monday morning, I want you to come into my office. You will ruin their weekend. The human mind cannot stand the unresolved. It cannot stand being without a crucial bit of information. When it feels that this information is important or somehow essential or profoundly in the crux of our lives, the mind will find it very difficult to settle. Because that's what the mind is conditioned to do, to try to, that's our evolutionary advantage. We don't run faster than lions, I think. Or rampaging, you know, cougars or whatever. We don't particularly claw better than them. We don't swim particularly well. But we can cogitate along with the best of them, can't we? So that's what the mind is trying to do. And this, all this excessive obsessive thought causes stress. It releases cortisol, releases adrenaline, and it takes its toll. It was a fascinating study by Harvard where they had they broke people up into three groups. One group where they taught them the scales on the piano. None of these people were piano players, so they taught them a scale, and then each day for a week, they would have them just play the scale repetitively for, I think, a half an hour. The second group, they taught the scale, but then they said, you're going to just visualize for a half an hour each day playing the scale. You're not actually going to play it on a piano. You're just going to imagine yourself playing the scale. The third group, they didn't teach any scale, and they said, just go about doing what you do. So within the course of a week, they gave them all a second set of fMRI scans, and they determined that the people who were playing the scale on the piano, the motor neurons in the parietal lobe that control finger movement started spreading into all the areas around it. They used the analogy spreading like dandelions through a field, a neighbor's yard. The brain started rewiring itself. The second group, the people who imagined playing the piano but actually didn't actually touch a piano, the exact same thing happened. It didn't matter whether you were actually playing a piano or just visualizing and imagining it in your mind. You started rewiring your brain. The third group, there was no change in the motor neurons. So it doesn't matter whether you're thinking something or doing something. Neuroscientists have begun to discover it. It's actually, either way, you're beginning to rewire the brain. And along with this study, a fascinating other study done by, I think it was Yale, where they actually determined that within a month of people meditating 20 minutes a day, we start rewiring the brain. So we start sending axons back. I think it's neural connections from the frontal lobe back to the amygdala, allowing us to override fear and emotional responses. We also start creating more and more connections to the cingulate, which is the part of the brain that allows us to focus calmly. So you start rewiring the brain, no matter what it is you're doing, very quickly. As neuroscientists say, neurons that fire together wire together. There's another way it's been described by a neuroscientist named Edelman called neural Darwinism. The thoughts we think get wired, hardwired into the brain and change your brain in the way that they make it much more likely that these thoughts you'll think again. So if you worry today about something, you're increasing the likelihood that this worrying pattern will repeat itself again in your brain. If, on the other hand, you practice letting go or putting down or putting aside something you're worrying about for a while, you increase the ability to do that. Every single thing you do with your brain wires it for the future. This is an almost exact analogy for what the Buddha called karma. The Buddha said that karma is every thought or action is a seed we plant that will grow into a future mind state, or could grow into a future mind state. Not everything we think or do necessarily does grow, but he says every thought and every action has the potential to create the mind that we will live in the future. So karma basically is the neuroscience of 2,500 years ago. And it still makes sense today. Because actually today, neuroscientists are using meditation and showing that it effectively rewires the brain away from our original stressful, worried, excessively cogitating and thought-based outlook to a mind that efficiently processes information but can stop thinking when the time is called for it. Thinking is great, but when you want to fall asleep or relax or get laid, whatever, it's not the greatest thing to be doing. It's good to have a mind that can be able to let go of a thought that's pounding it. Put it aside, and then come back to it later with a fresh perspective. The Buddha said that there's three things we do in any given situation that determines the future state that the mind will be in, how the karma of an action or thought will play out. The first is, in every given moment, we have a certain intention. This is the agenda that we're bringing in. For instance, we've all come to Dharma Punks tonight, and your agenda could be, oh good, I'm just going to relax. Or, oh my God, I'm just coming here for a friend, and I just want to get through this so I can get to some dinner. Why am I here with these weird people sitting here? Or it could be one of just complete, without any, you know, noted agenda, but just one of inquisitiveness. So we have certain agendas. Sometimes the agendas are clinging. I want this to last forever. Sometimes the agendas are adverse. I want to get through this time so I can get to something I'm looking more forward to. Or sometimes it's just, I just want to relax and see what this is like when you go to a movie, for example. So that's one element that determines how we will neurally wire our brain in any given situation. The second is, what is the level of attention that we bring? And this is where neuroscience really seconds this observation. They've determined that the amount of attention you give to a thought determines the amount you hardwire it into your mind. So if you really focus on something, like when we focus on a worrying thought, how much money will I have in the future? Will I be able to pay this bill? Will I ever get out of debt? I will die in poverty, whatever. These thoughts, the more we focus and give them our undivided attention, the stronger we're going to hardwire them into our brains. On the other hand, a divided, jumpy attention creates that kind of a mind as well. Finally, so of course, if the attention is on a thought that's very skillful, like compassion, generosity, goodwill,
those thoughts will be, those peaceful, less stressful thoughts will be hardwired into the brain. And finally, there's the level of perception. How do we perceive what's going on? And this is sometimes, in the Buddha says, we perceive each moment in terms of our story. Why is this always happening to me? Why am I always stuck in traffic? Why does somebody always cut me off when I'm on my bike? Why do I always have to work late? Whatever. We turn everything into a thing about us. The Buddha says a much more skillful perception that can determine whether or not we encode something into our brains that's stressful is if we instead think in terms of the universal quality of everything we experience. Rather than taking things personally, instead when we're going through a difficult situation or conversation or somebody is suddenly being very, very unskillful around us, if we reflect and we say, well, this is what it means to be a human being. All human beings experience upsetting situations. All human beings experience somebody rejecting, criticizing, shouting, being an idiot. It's just the nature of human experience. And to reflect that this person is not doing it to us. They're just doing what they do. Famous Buddhist analogy of other beings are often people who are not exercising calmness and free will are like empty boats bumping into us. They're not really being driven by anyone. They're just an empty vehicle crashing into us. There's nothing personal about it. So reflecting that this is what we're experiencing is not about me tends to lessen the impact of the stressful parts of life and tend to less reinforce the brain's stressful, worried, agitated, defensive, must get through life at all costs type nature. So I'm going to conclude by just reading a list I've made of some of the tools that the Buddha said are useful in rewiring the brain away from stress, agitation, and worry, and towards calmness and peace. And this is a list from various suttas and the numbered discourses. The first is kamatana and bhavana, which means to practice meditation in a way that we're not just practicing focusing the mind, which is important in and of itself, but also to practice during meditation skillfully reflecting on things that are important to cultivate. We can use our meditation as times to reflect on times we've been virtuous in life, when we've refrained from harming or hurting or stealing or doing something unskillful, to feel good about that. To think thoughts of generosity and compassion where normally we would think thoughts of, just coldness, indifference, and a sense of, they had it coming to them. Compassion is a wonderful thought because it doesn't reinforce this wall of I'm in it for myself and nobody, I can't relax because it's everybody for themselves. When we think thoughts of generosity and compassion and goodwill, we're sort of brick by brick, thought by thought, taking down that wall that separates us and makes us feel the need to constantly be defensive and on the lookout and always on guard. Sati, or mindfulness, is the practice of during the day regularly checking in and seeing if your body is holding stress. Very often when we act unskillfully, when we shout or yell or get frustrated, it's because beneath the level of our awareness, the body is really contracted and stressful and tight. And we're trying to get out, push out that that felt contraction by putting it out onto someone else. When you talk about it like this, it sounds ridiculous, but we so often wind up getting stressed out and yelling or acting unskillfully simply because we're trying to push out of us this underlying physically held stress. And if instead, during the day, we can notice what the body is doing, where the body is holding its tension, breathe into it, relax, and ease out the tension, we're much less likely to take out our frustrations on somebody nearby us. Generally, we don't, if there is somebody to blame, we almost inevitably never take it out on them. We take it out on the people who are closest to us, who happen to be around. Nekama means to practice self-restraint to a certain degree. Doesn't mean doing without. The Buddha was very clear that we all need clothing and shelter and food and medication and exercise. And he talks about them. He refers to them as the requisites. But he says the problem is that we don't have any sense of what's enough. And when we feel there's something missing in life, when we feel stress, when we feel a sense of aloneness or loneliness or lack of connection, rather than addressing that directly, we tend to try to consume. And so rather than go out into the world and try to fill ourselves up when we're feeling lonely or sad with stuff, the Buddha taught to get a real sense of what's enough to survive, really cherish the things that we've skillfully accumulated, and but then also to then know, okay, I have enough. My solution is not going to come now from accumulating more things, from bringing up the old credit card, in my case, buying another hoodie. I have too many hoodies. I have a hoodie weakness. But to really reflect at times, like, wow, this is not going to be solved by doing something out there. It's a really important practice. There was once a famous story of Ajahn, I think Munindo was asked by a woman who had a real issue with whenever she had a stressful day at work, she would go by the donut store and munch down donuts. And she was aware that she was trying to deal with her stress by shoving it down with food. And she came to Ajahn Munindo and she said, I've come up with a solution. I'm so proud of myself. I'm walking the other way home. I'm avoiding the donut store. And Munindo said, well, that's not really the solution. The solution is to walk by the donut store when you're stressed out, to feel the stress rise up, and to know that by eating a donut, it's not going to make the stress go away. It's just going to make it go away for a little while, and then it's going to be back again the next day. That you're in a cycle, and that this is not going to make anything, this is not addressing anything. And then to really feel the sense of, ah, I can't stand my job. And to say it's okay, and just to be with the feeling until the feeling begins to know that it's okay for it to be felt, and we don't need to push it away with food. The next is, Sila as well is practicing right speech. There's times we really, really, we can't get the physical stress relieved, and we just really want to let somebody know that they're a schmuck. We really want to hit the send button on the email. We really want to send that Facebook message. And it's really important to just, at that point, reflect that what happened the last time when I really unloaded on somebody? Did it really make me feel better in the long term? When we practice that, we really begin to see, wow, this is not going to solve anything. And this ability to restrain ourselves from acting unskillfully or trying to take it out on someone else begins to train the mind that when we are really stressed out, we don't have to get it out in the first most unskillful way that pops into the mind. Susasati is the Buddhist term for how to listen, which means that as we go out in the world and we meet people who are not unskillful, who are friendly or who are just part of our lives but are not acting aggressively, that just have we're just in conversation with, it's really important to be able to listen without planning what we're going to say while they're talking. This need to constantly in our mind have our, oh, I know what I'm going to say as soon as they shut the fuck up. I got it. Oh, I got the best thing to say. Oh, no, they're changing the subject. Fuck. This need to plan what we're going to say and not really let somebody finish before we already have, you know, we already know what subject and anecdote and thing we want to say, is part of this idea that we have to remain constantly on guard, constantly figuring everything out, that we cannot allow ourselves to be peaceful and relaxed, that we always have to have everything figured out. And I've practiced this, especially I really do this a lot after I come back from retreats, where I'll really set aside a long period of time where I'll really try to just be in conversations without having any thought about how I'm going to reply until somebody's finished talking. And that practice is so valuable because it trains me that even if I don't have it all figured out, I still do perfectly fine. You know, part of my brain says, oh no, unless you figure it all out right now and you know exactly what you're going to say, you know, somebody else is going to jump in and nobody's going to, you're not going to get your time. Your talk time, as if that should be a worry for me, right? I just sit here and blather several times a week. But Conti is being tolerant and patient. What it really means is that, as I said earlier, throughout life the Buddha said that we're going to, and he gives this really hysterical list, because it starts out with insects and bug bites and snakes and worms, and gnats, and other people. And it's like all these insects, and there's other people. Basically, that's where you're going to find the bulk of your the stuff you have to practice patience with. We're all going to just experience, and my experience is invariably, I bike everywhere. And it's the most challenging thing for me, because the more externally focused I am in any given endeavor, the more likely I am to struggle with being constantly, you know, apamata, which means on guard to not do anything unskillful. When I'm flooded out in the world, that's when I'm least aware of the stress that's building up, the tension. I'm not monitoring the skillfulness of what I'm about to say. And so when I'm riding my bike and there's inevitably a pedestrian that will walk with a phone, and basically, even though they're walking right into the bike lane against a red light, they will basically look at me like, you're not going to run me over. And it's left up to me to screech to a halt, my heart and my throat, you know, beating, you know, palpitating. And just look at them, and, you know, it's that, yes, this is going to happen to everyone. This person is not doing it to me. I could be an entirely different bike rider, and they would be doing the exact same fucking thing, which is, it's not about me. This is what it means to ride a bike in New York. And I don't have to be the one to tell this person what an idiot they are. Not that I've never done it, but most of the time I... And my, being a Buddhist of long practice, when I try to yell at somebody, it comes out so weird and distorted. Because part of me is like... So I'm like editing myself when I'm trying to, like, you know, get up and say... Literally, I once said to somebody in a huff, "You're unskillful!" This is like the lamest. This is like the lamest thing that anybody's ever said. I just, like, wanted to die from shame. The person was like, I think they felt sorry for me, too. Like, you know, I'm totally capable of calling you a moron, and you don't seem to be able to return the favor. So. Anyway, so that's, those are the ways to start rewiring your mind away from stress and agitation towards peace, just to reflect, having a daily practice, focusing the mind, reflecting on skillful things like generosity and compassion, practicing being, having limits to how much we need to acquire and feeling really good about what we've skillfully acquired, remembering that the solution to stress is not out there, but is instead mindfully becoming aware of the feelings that need attention and then eventually allowing them to relax and subside, listening without needing to prepare everything we're going to say beforehand, and some other really worthy stuff that I said but I can't remember right now because I'm having a Rick Perry moment. So thank you so much for listening, and now is your turn to ask any questions that you